Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
Today's program has been brought to you by GreatBrewers.com, a social media marketing platform dedicated to promoting the world's great brewers and the beers they create. For more information, visit GreatBrewers.com.
Hey, 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 I'm Jimmy Carboni from Beer Sessions Radio. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit HeritageRadioNetwork.org for thousands more.
Good evening and welcome to
Fomantic About It
on HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
I'm Mary Izette.
And I'm Chris Kuzmi.
And we're your co-hosts through this weekly journey of all things fermented.
Archived on Stitcher, iTunes, and right here on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. This is our 95th episode, and we are incredibly, incredibly excited to host Charlie Papazian here in the studio. Charlie, how are you doing?
It's super to be here.
It is fantastic. It is really super. You have influenced so many lives on a great number of levels and kind of have made our lives taste better through what you do. And we are very, very thankful for that. But let's start at the beginning on how this came to be.
Yeah. Well, you know, you've segued into a lot of things that I think about. You know, it's not just about the beer, but it's about the people you meet and about the things you do in your life and the foods and tastes and friendships, but how did I start? That was your question,
you
right?
Yes. Let's
sidetrack too quickly.
Who were you? There was rumor of nuclear engineer somewhere in there.
Yeah. Then I started drinking homebrew, and I became dyslexic, and nuclear became unclear, and I went into homebrewing as a career, so to speak. But in the early days, 1970 was the first time I ever tasted a homebrew and made homebrew.
If I'm not mistaken, that was illegal at that time.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Made it kind of more fun.
Okay, there you go.
But it didn't stop us. And, you know, the state of homebrewing was, in my mind at that time, was there wasn't a state of homebrewing. People had this notion that home brewing was something your grandfather did during Prohibition and brewed it in the bathtub and the bottles exploded and the stuff tasted awful. That was where the state of home brewing was at. And a neighbor of mine who ran a daycare center and a preschool when I was a student, he was beyond being a student and he had a little business, and he would come down and share stories and beers in the evenings after work and between when we were doing homework and and drinking 69 cents a six-pack Ballantine ale, which was, you know, we were drinking it not because we enjoyed the flavor or a sense of satisfaction, but it was just the thing you do as a college student, right? Mm-hmm. He said, you know, I discovered my neighbor makes homebrew. Would you like to try some? Why don't we go over there and try, see if we can try some? And we did. A couple of days later, we went there, and he was an old-timer, lived during the Prohibition days.
Okay.
And he said, yo, you want to try some homebrew? And he said, yeah. I said, well, let me get some good stuff, the stuff that I've been aging for a year. And he went down in his basement, and he came back up with a big brown quart bottle of homebrew, cracked the top, and we tasted it. And I thought to myself, wow, I've never tasted beer like this. This is interesting. It has some character to it. And I proceeded to discuss how he made it. And then he said, wait a minute, I'll write you the recipe. And it was on a little 3x5 card. It was about 6 lines. And that was my beginning. And from there, I made some pretty lousy homebrew. The first 2 batches went down the drain. But then being kind of an engineering school and, you know, your whole life is figuring out problems and getting to where you need to go. And I figured out a few things I could tweak in the recipe. Better yeast, not bread yeast, but beer yeast, you know, some sugars, better sugars, and a little bit more sanitation. And we were on our way making beer that our friends loved. And we celebrated often. We made beer, and we couldn't make enough. And that was how I started.
That is fantastic.
And at that time, well, first of all, I can't even imagine where you got your supplies from. But second of all, I'm sure when you shared this beer with your friends, they had never had anything like it. We didn't. I mean, there was very little beer that resembled what we have now on the market. I think most people were drinking light lagers at the time.
Exactly. I mean, the state of the beer business was, you know, breweries were going out of business left and right. And light lager was the landscape.
Yeah.
Every once in a while, you discover some kind of dark beer, you know, some strange name like porter or stout. never heard of that before. And we would explore putting, you know, darker malts to make darker beers. But our sophistication was at a very elementary level. I mean, but it was good enough to keep us going.
Absolutely.
And, you know, it's interesting, you know, with all this hop-o-mania these days. It was not until about 1974 when after I had moved to Colorado, where I live now in Boulder, when I started teaching classes that I actually saw my first hops. I didn't know what hops were. I was just using hop flavored malt extract that you could get in the supermarket.
Wow, you could get hop flavored extract in the supermarket.
Yes, because of course
for what use?
For making muffins. Of course.
Right. right.
Everybody wants hops in their muffins.
I do now. For sure.
So then what was it? So then you moved to Boulder and you started teaching homebrewing classes.
I did. People discovered that I knew how to make beer and they said, "Charlie, teach us how to make beer." So all of a sudden I was on my way back into homebrewing because I had left all my equipment back in the East Coast and moved out to Boulder with backpack and there I was starting a new life and started making beer for teaching people how to make beer and then the Community Free School, an organization that let you teach whatever your passions were in those days, said, "Charlie, you're going to teach a class for us." And I said, "Okay." So people would come over to my house once a week, you know, for few-hour sessions, and we'd brew beer, and we'd have graduation classes, and people loved to flunk that class.
And this is,
retake the class.
This is still mid-70s, right?
Yeah, mid-70s. Yeah.
Pre-legal, so these are science classes.
Yeah, yeah.
Yes.
And, you know, you could get your supplies at wine-making supply stores. They had malt extract and things that looked like, well, they were hops, but they didn't look like hops.
Yeah.
and the equipment to make beer. And it wasn't until 1978 that federal legislation was tacked on to a transportation bill to legalize homebrew, and it was signed into law in 79 during Carter's administration in the depths of an incredible recession. So it was legal.
Signed by Alan Cranston.
Yes, he was one of them, yes.
I have a signature on the back of a shirt. I was a precinct leader for Michael Dukakis when I was 8. It was weird. It was great. But anyway, that's why I know that name. So that was 1978, 79,
right.
Where it was signed.
And coincidentally, that was the year that I started the American Homebrewers Association.
Right, yeah.
And it didn't have anything to do that we knew homebrewing was going to be legal. It was just we were going to do this regardless because we had formed a network of beer enthusiasts and homebrewers in the Boulder, Denver, Colorado area that were really, really passionate about what we were learning and discovering. And we thought it'd be kind of cool to start a newsletter and share recipes. And, you know, you drink a homebrew every so often, you drink a little too much, and you start thinking, well, that newsletter could become a magazine. The magazine could become an association. We could have a national organization. Let's do it. Sure. So one of the first things we did, we went to the public library and looked in all the phone books of major cities in the United States in the yellow pages and looked up wine and beer making supplies, got addresses to kind of let people know because that was the only way to
You wrote letters. I mean, that was before email or cell phones or anything.
It was a hard sell. We were depicted as these crazy hippies in Boulder that wanted to start an organization for homebrewers. Are you kidding me?
That's pretty big. So it started in that first year. What was the recruitment as far as first membership? Or what was that ride?
The magazine came out in December of 1978, and I think by year end we had 100 members. Mm-hmm. By the year end 79, we may have had a couple of hundred members. We were selling membership for $6 a year, probably. And it was at about that. It was during that period of time I also wrote my first versions of The Joy of Homebrewing, which mm-hmm. was in the beginning. It was a self-published 76-page, 80-page book that I took to the printer and had them print. And before that, it was a mimeograph sheet that I would hand out in my class. So I self-printed and self-published those two original editions. Maybe there's probably 4,000 copies out there, and every once in a while somebody shows up at a signing and says, hey, do you remember this?
That's incredible. Yeah. It was officially published in 1984.
Right. That was the first Avon, now part of HarperCollins, publication. It was the first big edition, and I had recently traveled to England, and I learned a lot about brewing by visiting breweries there, and by that time I had befriended people at Coors Brewing Company, and they were very helpful in helping me understand the way they made beer. Mm-hmm. And the problem in those days was most of the homebrewing books were from England, and with their attitude towards brewing is like, make cheap beer, make beer with lots of sugar, and age your beer a long time. They didn't know why they needed to age it, but it helped because of their procedures were not what I discovered was you visit breweries and you read these homebrew books, and there was a disconnect. It's like all these things got just passed on from homebrewer to homebrewer without really understanding the science and the art of real brewing. So, excuse me. What I ended up doing is observing and learning brewing on a larger scale, whether it was a microbrewery or a brew pub in England or Coors Brewing Company, and scaling that down. I guess that's where my engineering kind of mindset came into play, is that I was able to kind of scale down from thousands of barrels to down to 5-gallon batches and processes and, the flow of the process. To something that was understandable and comprehensible mm-hmm. to somebody who's going to wants to make great beer at home. And I remember my book came out, it was $7.95, which was three times as expensive as any homebrew book out there. And homebrew shops in the beginning would not carry it because they said, no homebrew's going to spend that kind of money on a book. So the book really got a lot of play in the bookstores. I mean, tens of thousands of these books were being sold at bookstores, not at homebrew shops. And then finally, the homebrew shops figured it out. People are coming in with these books and buying equipment and supplies based on these recipes. Maybe there's something to this. Charlie Papazian, American Homebrewers Association, these hippies in Boulder that are starting something. So those are the early days.
Yeah.
We did invent at 508 Gastrobrewery last night and had some chats. One of the things that actually brought tears to my eyes, tears of joy and beauty, is you still brew 5 gallons.
I do.
At a time now.
I still do.
And you have the same pot that you started with.
Well, not quite, but I do have the same spoon.
Nice.
I have that on my shelf. Maybe it'll be in a museum. Actually, I've been approached by a museum.
That is awesome.
That's amazing. But you talked about the beauty of brewing on such a small scale. I mean, you were just talking about big Coors versus small little 5 gallons, mm-hmm. and just the how special it is to do that and the freedom that you have as a home brewer to be doing 5 gallons at a time.
You know, the cool thing about that thought is that the Coors people and the bigger brewers eventually, they were really interested in what we were doing at 5 gallons at a time because they took the inspirations that were coming out of our 5-gallon batches and ramped them up to their scale to see what they could do. Mm-hmm. So things flipped around.
Yeah.
Yeah, no doubt. And on that note, we're going to take a break. We'll be right back with more Charlie Papazian.
Ferment about it.
Ferment. So, you like good beer. Whether you're a craft beer pro or just had your first sip of an IPA, GreatBrewers.com is your number one beer resource on the internet. GreatBrewers.com bridges the gap between the world's great brewers and the consumers who enjoy their products. With so much information and misinformation out there, GreatBrewers.com focuses on education and leaves no stone unturned. Take the Great Beer Test on their website and browse through an extensive product catalog. Download their mobile Beer Cloud app, which includes a GPS beer finder, a beer sommelier, and descriptions for over 5,000 different brews. What are you waiting for? Back up that passion for craft beer with some solid information and education. Visit GreatBrewers.com today.
Welcome back to Ferment About It on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. We're sitting in the studio with Charlie Papazian. Thank you so much for being here again. This is our 95th episode, and we couldn't be more thrilled to be hosting you. Yeah. We are talking about homebrewing. We're talking about 1984 and the release of The Complete Joy of Homebrewing, your first publication, and the journeys through it.
And here we are. It's the 30th anniversary of that big edition, yes. And the fourth edition has just come out.
Just come out in September, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
And we'll just take you back. So this book, The Complete Joy of Homebrewing, is what I started with. I have my third edition with me. It's in remarkably good shape. I wonder if I rebought it.
Yeah, I don't see any beer stains on it.
I know. This was originally published back in 2003. And this was, I mean, this is the Bible of homebrewing. This is how a lot of us learned.
But the third edition was 2003?
Yeah, the third edition was 2003. But I think, I mean, it's amazing. It's an amazing book. And now the fourth. So tell us what inspired you to come out with the fourth edition 11 years later.
Well, a lot changes in 10-year cycles in the world of beer and home brewing. And at the time, it was due, and I talked to my publisher at HarperCollins, and they agreed that it was time for another edition. And I said, by the way, you also published The Homebrewer's Companion, my other book, which is the sequel, and it's the volume two. It's the more advanced version of The Complete Joy of Homebrewing. And that had been published in 1994, I believe, 93, 94. And I wrote it in 92. So that was in badly need of revision. So I took on both books as needing revision, and we went for it. And it was a two-year project to go through every single word and every chart and every procedure and look at the new literature and integrate it into these books. Now, you might be wondering, well, what do you change in there? One of the things I don't, one of the things I don't change is the whole aspect of my approach to brewing, which is this is a hobby. Beer is fun. You should enjoy it. And it's not just a technical tome on how beer is made.
Right.
It's the spirit of camaraderie and networking and having fun, and while at the same time covering all the basic principles of what beer is all about. You know, how the ingredients, the process, the procedures, the science. But I don't get too technical with regards to all the gadgets, because there's so much happening with home brewing right now.
Yeah,
and there are a lot of books and a lot of things you can find on the internet,
right,
that are some pretty cool and amazing brew systems. But if you read my two books, you will understand the brewing process and the home brewing process, and you'll be able to go in any direction you want. You could get geeky with yeast and microbiology. You could get geeky with hops, and you could geeky with styles. You can really get into the science, the gadgets, the equipment. You can build a larger brewery, or you can, like me, 5 gallons at a time. I'm still using the 10-gallon pot to mash in. I don't use pumps, motors. I use siphon. I love gravity.
Yeah, gravity. Yeah.
Gravity is
your
good
friend.
Thing.
Yes. And you still do a cold water bath, right?
I still do a cold water bath. And theoretically, you read my book they used to make malts that would create certain corn-like characters in your beer if you chilled your beer down too slowly.
Mm-hmm.
But I've never experienced that with my slow chilling. So I continue to do it that way despite the theory.
If it ain't broke, don't fix it.
Right? Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah.
So when you came out with The Homebrewer's Companion, what was the impetus for that, and why should people have both books? And should you buy them in order?
Yes, you should buy them in order. If you're a beginning homebrewer, get The Complete Joy of Homebrewing, and that will take you through 450 pages of beer style information, the principles of fermentation, the basics of, you know, what ingredients go in beer, and inspiration to use to experiment with all kinds of spices and herbs and fruits and other things you might have around locally that you might want to put in your beer. And lots of recipes. The emphasis is more on malt extract. I'd say 50% of the recipes are malt extract recipes, which is you can make a beer in 2 to 3 hours from start to clean up. And my homebrewer's companion gets more into the details about what's happening with malted barley and grains, and I extensively more information about the science and art of using hops in this, the 21st century, because things have changed a lot. People are using hops in ways that were unimaginable 15, 20 years ago. And understanding the principles behind that, really you can create some amazingly flavored beers just by understanding where those flavors come from and how to preserve them and how to get them in your beer in different ways. And there are a lot more all-grain recipes in the Homebrewer's Companion, but I don't leave the malt extract homebrewer behind, because you can continue to be a malt extract brewer and become even more advanced in just making beer with more finesse and really zeroing in on what you really like. And the neat thing, I was thinking about this in my own brewing, is that I like to make often the same recipes over and over again. I also like to create new recipes, go in new directions with different ingredients. And I also like to go back in time, because there are so many beer types that have evolved to something else, like the original Pilsners of 20, 30 years ago. They're largely gone commercially, or even the German-style Helles that I remember drinking back in the 80s when I first visited Germany. You go to Germany now, and they're a different beer. I hate to say it, but they've dumbed it down. You know, it's not as flavorful, not as malty, not as much hop character. And I remember those beers, so I go back in time and recreate the beers that I remember, whether it's the Guinness Stout that was made with real hops rather than hop extract, which it is now, and real roasted barley, and it was bottle conditioned. All Guinness was bottle conditioned in the bottles, not anymore. And I remember those flavors, whether it's German beer, or Belgian beer, or English beer, or even American, some American styles. You can go back and recreate those flavors again.
Yeah, that's fantastic. And I think we've talked about this on the show before, but I think that's one thing. A lot of homebrewers kind of, you know, they start with extract and then maybe go to partial mash and then go to all grain. And a lot of times they forget about extract. And I think it's important to be able to go back to extract. A lot of times people don't have enough time to brew. And the other thing is our ingredients these days, I mean, we can get super fresh extracts. It's a whole different ballgame.
Oh,
much
is.
A lot of people make award-winning, absolutely delicious beers with extract.
I remember one guy who was an all-grain brewer. He just for kicks, he entered a malt extract beer into a competition, a state competition. He won Best of Show with his malt extract beer. And he said, "Charlie, I made this with malt extract."
Yeah.
Just like your book.
Yeah.
you know, and you're right. The ingredients are fresher. Back in the 70s, when we were just starting out, there weren't enough people making homebrew. And extract would sit on the shelf. And, you know, beer is food and the ingredients are food. And, you know, they change with time. You can make malt extract beer with the proper good quality yeast and good hops that is not, you can't distinguish it between all grain and extract.
I would agree. The other thing is that there's a lot more varieties of extract available now. I mean, we can get light Pilsner extract, there's a huge spectrum and a lot more specialty malts in.
Exactly.
You know.
Yep. And you know how many homebrewers there are in this country?
How many
now?
1.25 million homebrewers.
That's
you know, when you figure out the adult population, that's one in every of every 200 people.
That's awesome.
Are homebrewers. And you got to figure, how many beers do you share with your friends that are not homebrewers?
Right.
So how many people have tasted homebrew? Not many Americans have that kind of vacancy in their life, you know, that absence. That you, people, a lot of Americans know. This is a nation of brewers.
Yeah, oh, absolutely.
And so. It's getting stronger. I think it's interesting. You were talking about beer styles and you know, when you started, you brewed because you couldn't get these beers and those flavors. But now we can get all these flavors. Like, the world has gotten smaller through just the advancement. And so it takes a certain person to kind of homebrew. But also, I think, speaking to extract, it's you don't need a lot of time. You don't need a lot of resource. And a lot of people are daunted by the idea of homebrewing when it doesn't have to be so complicated.
That's right. You
relax,
know,
don't worry.
I have maintained my approach to homebrewing to be 5 gallons at a time, maybe at the most 6. And not sophisticated equipment. And I still brew, you know, 12 to 15 times a year on average. And I know homebrewers that have ramped up their system, and, you know, it's not 5 gallons, it becomes 15 gallons, and maybe it becomes 30 gallons, and they have a super system, and they make great, great beer, but they don't brew as often.
Right.
And I personally love the whole creation process. You know, you spend the morning brewing beer. You're either outside in the summer if you have nice weather, or you're inside and heat up the house with nice steamy aromas of beer making. And it's a great hobby.
Absolutely. And also, we touched on this a little bit before the show, the community of homebrewers is absolutely amazing. We were talking about just New York City is a huge city, largest city in the country, and most of the homebrewers here know each other. We have a lot of public homebrew events that people can taste homebrew. We have Josh Bernstein does homebrew tours. So he takes a group of people into homebrewers' apartments or houses and introduces them to their homebrew. And the community, we at the National Homebrewers Conference this year, I mean, it's been growing every year, and it's an absolutely amazing event. We've met so many people there that we've kept in touch with over the years. And, you know, that's something that I always look forward to at the Homebrewers Conference, besides, you know, learning the seminars and tasting all the beer, is just meeting people.
Well, you know, Heritage Radio Network is about a community of people and a network of people that love creations that are cultural and tasty and food-oriented. And, you know, what craft brewers and homebrewers have done over the last 30 or 40 years is, I think, people are beginning to realize that homebrewers are pioneers and are great examples of what can be done with food and beverage of other types, whether it's kombucha or, you know,
craft distilling.
Craft distilling, or even local, you know, supporting local farmers, you know, the whole slow food movement. You know, it's fascinating that, you know, in the early days of slow food, when I was visiting Italy, and I started the first Convivium slow food in Boulder, Colorado, first U.S. Convivium, and it was kind of doing everything all over again for me. It was turning people on to not just beer, but just the whole wider world of beer and food, because beer's my business, and I work late. So
that T-shirt is in your picture in the book. When you're standing in front of it, it's awesome. I was actually going to bring that up. Yeah. That picture.
So, what do you think? What are some of your favorite things that are going on in homebrewing? I mean, besides just the growth of this homebrew community and the movement, what else do you like?
Well, one of the things that I love about homebrewing are the people I meet and all the walks of life they come from. I mean, I still taste great beers from people of all ages, all shapes, all colors. It's happening all over the world as well. It's not just in the USA, but in Latin America, in parts of Africa, and parts of Asia, Europe. There's a whole renaissance of people wanting to understand the food and beverage that they're enjoying, and beer is so much more accessible than it was 40 years ago.
Yeah.
You know, the books that were out there, if you wanted a book on brewing, you have to pop for $150 for a technical book. And so making that information accessible through my books and many other books, we, as the American Home Brewers Association, we started a publication company called Brewers Publication that started publishing books that were made brewing and beer information more accessible. So that in our back of our minds, that's what we were trying to do, is make, and through networking and the people that we've met. I also think about, there's government affairs matters too, because home brewing was only legalized in the last of our 50 states in 2013. Yep. Alabama and Mississippi, kind of, it's kind of an odd pair there, but they were the last two to legalize it. Mm-hmm. And there was there was political efforts that needed to be done, and still, to protect the homebrewers' rights and make sure you can brew a batch of beer and share it with your friends outside your house. Yep. I mean, there's some strange laws out there.
Yes, there are. Absolutely.
So I think about that, and some of the research that we've done, and there's been over 120,000, maybe a couple hundred thousand jobs that are kind of indirectly and directly associated with craft brewing and home brewing. And, it all starts with 1 5-gallon batch at a time. This 95% or more of the people in the small and independent craft brewery business started out home brewing.
Yep, yep. And with your book, which is available where?
It's available at bookstores. It's available at homebrew supply shops, and it's also electronically available. There's e-book editions, awesome. Kindle and Barnes and Noble and Amazon, all those formats. And the neat thing, I've kind of cruised through some early prototypes of those e-books, and I noted some of the cool things that they did. They linked various sections. When the book references another section, you can click on that link and go right to it. So it's very navigable.
Yeah.
That's the word. And I'm not even drinking beer yet.
Syllabables. It's a lot of syllabables.
Yeah, I'm a huge fan of paper books, but I also actually a lot of times I'll buy the paper edition and the e-edition, because you can always carry it. Like I'm in a homebrew tonight, I can go by the homebrew store and, have your book on my phone and easily access.
Yeah,
and you can
do a word search.
A question, absolutely.
What's this Tettnanger hops? Do they grow in the U.S.? Let's do a search on Tettnanger and see what Charlie says.
Yeah. Awesome. Yep.
Charlie, thank you so much for joining us on The Men About It.
You've been such an inspiration.
Tickled to have you here. Absolutely.
Well, I'm excited to be here, and I'm excited about the two books, and I still have my day job at the Brewers Association, which is part of the American Home Brewers Association, and we have 43,000 members, and if you really want to continue to plug into that network, join the American Home Brewers Association. 43,000 members, and
you get Zymergy
magazine,
which is fantastic, and you get access to the archives, which,
and there's an electronic forum. You can get any question answered within a day or sooner.
And then local discounts. We get a free pint. Every time we go to the Brooklyn Brewery, we get a free pint.
Yep, so it pays for itself.
Yes. It does. I was going to say that there are over 27 deals for home brewers in the state of New York.
Yeah.
Brew pubs and craft beer restaurants where you get discounts. So you can pay. Your membership pays for itself.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Yep. If you like beer and not celiac.
That's at homebrewersassociation.org. So, and we're based in Boulder, Colorado. And come on to our Great American Beer Festival, too.
Yes.
That was started by homebrewers.
By you.
Right? And myself, right?
I went for my first time this year. I saw you there. And, it's absolutely fantastic. I mean, the whole world of homebrewing and craft beer is just incredibly exciting right now. So, absolutely. Thank you so much for being on the show, Charlie. And good luck with your book tour. And
thanks.
Man,
I'm going to go home, start a batch of yeast, and brew this weekend.
Awesome.
Right on. It's teach.
That's right. Teach a friend to homebrew day is this Saturday.
Right. Yeah, absolutely.
But this is airing 2 days after that. So I hope you enjoyed Teach a Friend to Homebrew Day. Thank you so much.
Yeah.
For Men About It, everybody. For Men About It.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archive programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.
I want to tell you about a new podcast called Amuse News. Publishing multiple days a week, Amuse News is your source for food news, interviews from around the food world, and more. On the show, we'll be engaging with food storytellers, from chefs to advocates to people working in the field, and many more. Find Amuse News wherever you get your podcasts. Amuse News is a destination for everyone who's looking for a new, insightful look into the world of food.